I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. And today we're going to have an overview from the Department of Human Services and then the AMA Center for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities and then a presentation from a number of our health-related boards. So we've got quite a bit to cover today, and we'll see how far we can get along that line. And we'll start with our overview from the Department of Human Services. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Come on down. And when we have the full quorum here, we'll call that meeting more formally to order. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Madam Chair, I prepared to present to you there are two base budget pages that I was in the budget of this committee, and there's also one change page that I believe the policy actually sits in Health and Human Services. The money is currently here. I'm not sure how you're sorting out responsibility for that. I'm starting on page 214, if that connects with the pages that you have for Human Services.
Yes, it does.
Madam Chair, this is the first of the base budget pages which addresses refugee services grants. Refugee services grants are federally funded grants provided by the federal government to support new refugees who arrive in Minnesota. Refugees, as most of you are aware, are people who are coming from another country and are unable to return to their home country because of a fear of persecution. And the State Department determines how those individuals and families are placed across the United States in various states. And as you know, Minnesota has had a lot of refugees over the last 20 years or so who have arrived here and settled in Minnesota. The services provided under refugee services grants include refugee cash and medical. There's essentially benefits that are provided to individuals who are not eligible for our TANF program, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or not eligible for Medicaid. There are also social services grants and employment services grants. A lot of focus in the program on helping refugees find employment and become self-sufficient after they arrive in the United States. And additional grants that help with other areas such as interpreters, referrals, English language instruction, and so forth. Over the last 5 years, we've had almost 22,000 new refugees arrive in Minnesota, and we use the dollars provided by the federal government to help support those individuals. If you look on page 216, you can see the total dollars that we have currently in our projecting within this budget area.
And in terms of the federal dollars that are available, can you describe the changes?
Well, Madam Chair, the refugee cash assistance and medical essentially follow the number of people that are coming in. So those dollars will ebb and flow depending on how many new entrants are coming to Minnesota. We have had a drop in new refugees in Minnesota. Last year we had, I believe it was about 1,800, which was down from over 5,000 the previous year. And we expect that this year, I'm sorry, it was 1,300 last year. We expect this year will be lower again, about in the range of 1,800. The budget page actually shows an increase going forward, and it's on page 216 you see the local assistance line. This is essentially the social services grants I mentioned before. Those are based on an allocation from the federal government that looks at the last 3 years of how many new entrants we've had, how many refugees we've had. The way the budget does is it looks at what we have right now and just kind of straight lines it across. So that's probably artificial in terms of what we will actually get. We won't know what we actually get until they redo the formula based on the last 3 years and then reissue the grant to us. But based on what I said earlier about our numbers having gone down last year and likely to be down again this year, we expect we'll probably receive fewer dollars through the social services grants than what's reflected here on the page. But again, the budget page is kind of just straight line things until we know how much we're actually getting. We don't have a way to put another number in place. I would also mention the services are provided through seven nonprofit organizations that we contract with, voluntary local agencies. These are not services that we deliver directly or that are delivered usually through counties or other entities. And so those agencies really help both to resettle and provide all the services that the families and individuals need to get adjusted to the United States.
Johnson, do you have a list of those nonprofits?
I do, and I can provide that to the committee, Madam Chair.
Okay. And do you know, based on the, you know, the mission of this program, what the outcomes are in terms of helping people find employment?
Madam Chair, the budget page presents two outcomes related to self-sufficiency, one showing the average wage at placement of individuals, and the other showing job retention rates. You can see those charts on page 214 and 215. I commented that the job retention rates, we're paying a little more attention to how the data is collected. That seems to be pretty sensitive to making sure that the counselors who are tracking individuals are actually following up and doing the counting after 90 days more than it is actually how many still have jobs. So we're trying to improve our data collection there so that the measure is better and hopefully more stable and representative of what's actually going on over time.
And Mr. Johnson, it looks like the retention rate is going down in the last 3 years, huh?
And Madam Chair, we think that that's mostly because of data collection problems as opposed to actual reductions in retention, but we need to have another year to look at. We've done more work at trying to remind counselors that they need to be doing this follow-up at 90 days to see whether we'll see an improvement then once we improve the data collection.
Any other questions, Mr. Johnson? Jim Powell.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, do you have the availability to break this down either rural or metro or by county as to how many participate in this program? And if so, this being federal dollars, is there a difference in help that they get monetarily from, let's say, Hennepin County to Kandy, Ohio to Cass County? Is there a difference in that? And if so, could you bring that to us later?
Madam Chair, Representative, we could get that information, certainly. There would be no difference in terms of the cash benefits they get. That would be set and consistent across the state. And then the types of services they get, all that would be driven by the employment provider and the service provider as to what resources they think the family needs in order to help get settled in the United States. Mm-hmm. We can provide the breakdown of where the individuals are living.
Well, and Madam Chair, one follow-up. Mr. Johnson, if you could also tell us, when you find employment for these folks, where do they do the best at? Do they hold these jobs longer in the metro area, or are rural jobs that are found, do they hold those longer? I'd like to see where they're succeeding the best and where they're failing the worst.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure how we have that information broken up, but we can look at that question and see what information we can provide to help with it.
I do have a question. Is there a reason that you don't go beyond the 90-day retention? I think that's really a very short period of time. I don't know what the average stay of refugees are, but many of them, of course, become citizens, and it seems like there's a short period of time to actually measure any outcome.
Madam Chair, it's fairly standard in employment and training programs to look at a 90-day follow-up as a retention rate. It gets somewhat more challenging to find people and to do the follow-up as you get further out, and it takes resources from the staff who would otherwise be helping people find jobs to be doing the follow-up instead. So it's really a trade-off between how much resources we want to put into data collection and what we think is a reasonable time period.
Okay. Any other discussion? If not, let's go on to the next.
Madam Chair, the next base budget page is on page 217 in your packet. This is a sort of catch-all of a lot of grants within the Children and Family Services area of the department that are all included in this budget activity. If you look on page 219, you can see the total dollars that are expended there. And if you look at the bottom for the total for fiscal year 09, for example, you see the total is $276 million. Just to give you a sense of what's on the page and a sense of scope, of that 276, $233 million of that is the federal food stamp program. So by far the biggest, well, there's a lot of small items encapsulated in this budget activity. There's one real big one, and that's the federal food stamp program, which has recently changed its name to be the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP. So that's the new federal acronym for what we have known historically as the food stamp program. In Minnesota, we call it the food support program. So that is the largest activity here from a dollar perspective. But there are a lot of other activities in this page that support important parts of what we do to try to help families and individuals in Minnesota, particularly in the housing and food areas. Supportive housing services grants as part of the effort to end long-term homeless are part of this activity. That's $5 million a year that we contract out with counties or consortium of counties to deliver services to long-term homeless to help them stay in supportive housing situations. Transitional housing programs provide transitional housing to families and individuals. Minnesota Community Action Grants to support the community action agencies, the 39 across Minnesota that help low-income individuals and families in those communities. Emergency services programs to fund shelters and also emergency food money, which provides food and resources to the food shelves across Minnesota, are part of this budget activity. The FAME program, Family Assets for Independence Minnesota, is a program that helps low-income families save money for the purposes of buying a house or going to school or starting a business. As I mentioned, the food support program, being the largest program here, provides food support through EBT to individuals to support their nutrition needs. And then also fraud prevention grants are included here. I'll talk a little more about that when I get to the change page. Madam Chair, so there's multiple activities here that are mostly granted out either to nonprofits or to counties for delivery by the department. Most of the money that's here is federal money that we are passing through to the local areas, again, in these various pots of money. And I would mention that several areas here are potentially areas that would benefit from the federal stimulus bill that's being negotiated in Washington right now.
Yes, can you go through that part, please?
Madam Chair, the areas that, and it's different in the House and the Senate, so whether these actually come through, we don't really know for sure. But the Emergency Food Assistance Program provides bulk food to the food shelf. Is in, I believe, at least one of the bills as a possible area for additional funding and resources. The HUD ESPG grants, the housing emergency housing grants, is another area we've seen in the stimulus bills. The community services block grant, which I mentioned, the dollars that go to support the local community action agencies, that is also a part of the stimulus bills. And then the food stamp program, probably the largest one. I believe there's a 12% bump in food stamp benefits in the Senate bill and a 14% bump in the House bill to the benefits for low-income families for a roughly two-year period.
Mr. Johnson, is that after yesterday's changes to the bill, or is that before yesterday's changes to the bill?
Madam Chair, that's the best that I knew before the changes
before
of yesterday's
changes.
Bill.
Because if I'm not mistaken, those are some of the very areas. I think there was some areas, I think, in food and not sure what else, were that were slated to be considered wasteful spending, and they were being cut. Am I correct?
I think some of the grants, and it may be some of these grants that were going to go to states, were included here, but I'm not. That's, again, only the Senate side of the bill, but so is the House bill, and so we'll have to conference those to determine what the final bill looks like.
Yeah. So before yesterday, anyway, there was an increase in food shelf grants. And then what did you say about in terms of the homeless?
I believe that one of the bill included some money, the Emergency Shelter Grant Program, the federal dollars we passed through to help emergency shelters.
Do you have any idea of the magnitude, what those numbers were?
Madam Chair, I don't.
That's something you could get to us, and I think it would be helpful maybe to have a running update.
Madam Chair, at this point, it's almost easier to wait to see if they pass the bill, and then we'll know what the actual dollar amount is. The one site that I've seen that's been providing numbers said they were going to stop providing numbers because it was changing too fast, and so I'm not sure whether we have good numbers right now as to what these might look like.
Well, that is one perspective. Another perspective is for those of us who are policymakers to try to influence our colleagues at the federal level. So if we see a big jump, big drop in one of these, you know, it's helpful to know that. I mean, we could probably get it from the news. I'm just thinking it would be helpful. If you have activity.
We can look at the sources we have, Madam Chair, and see if there's information there that would be helpful.
That would be great. Okay. Oh, Reverend Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner Johnson. Just a couple of, maybe a question or comment. On the long-term homeless service grants, I noticed that, I kind of went to the change page, so maybe. I noticed that we had, looks like $7 million, 2008 actual, and it looks like looks like $5 million in 2009. It's on page 337.
Yes, Madam okay. Chair and Representative Hayden. I believe that there was one-time money provided in 2008 for those services that is not in the base going forward, and that's why you see the difference there.
So I guess my question is, we have a plan, thank you, Madam Chair, we have a plan to end long-term homeless in the state that requires that there were kind of a couple pieces to it. One was to provide rental assistance or capital in order to build supportive housing to create a supportive housing environment for people that were long-term homeless. And with that, we also, which I think these dollars are dollars that provide service, case manager services and others to help people maintain their housing. So I guess my question is, how are we going to be able to meet our commitment of all of the dollars that we've expended on the housing side and building housing and creating real assistance opportunities if we're not matching that with the service dollars?
And Madam Chair, I think that that's a very appropriate question. I think that at this point in the effort on long-term homeless, we had hoped that there would be more money in the service side than we have here right now. And that's just been a function of the budget situation we've been in, our inability to get more money into the service account. It's working well for the places that have the dollars and for the individuals who are able to use those supportive services dollars on. But it is a challenge where we don't have those dollars or where we're developing new units and don't have the dollars to follow them, particularly not so much for some of the basic services, which you can get through becoming eligible through the multiple programs we already have, but kind of those glue case management services and some of those pieces that aren't covered by our existing infrastructure of programs that it takes to hold things together and to keep the supportive housing going. It is a challenge, and it would we thought, as I said before, that we'd be at a position now of having more money in the services, but we don't, and sort of managing as best we can with what we have.
Well, Mrs. Johnson, did your department recommend to continue that that increase in funding? That was, I mean, it was only one time because of the budget situation last year. Did you recommend that we continue that?
Madam Chair, I believe the governor's budget in 2007 did have an ongoing increase in long-term homeless funding here that was in the range of about $1.5 million a year, which was not adopted by the legislature. Instead, we got the one-time dollars.
And for this next year, did you recommend that it be continued? That
was my question. Madam Chair, the governor's recommendation is no increase.
All right. I'm just wondering if the department, it sounds like you recognize the big problem it creates, so.
Madam Chair, I do. We don't usually discuss what department recommends within the governor's budget process.
I know, that's a change. I've been here a long time where we used to talk about all of that. It was all open. Well, one of the things I was wondering is, can you document for us maybe the number of people that will not be served? Then you've looked at it. Could you give us an estimate of that? If you can't do it today, I'd really like to know what that would be so we can actually try to figure out how we might fill that gap or at least address, I mean, the emergency shelters, I would guess we're going to see some of those people showing up in emergency shelters. What are we talking about? Right now I know there's people who are not served. So if we could have a sense of that to prepare.
Madam Chair, we could put something together that looks at how these dollars are being used now, who's being served by them, and where we're continuing to develop more supportive housing without the support of services dollars in place.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
So I don't mean to be facetious, but I guess we can't call it supportive housing if we don't support the people in the housing, right? I mean, Commissioner Johnson, it's just housing that we're building without the support, so then that, by definition, wouldn't be supportive housing.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, that's true if there are no services, but the fact that we aren't funding services doesn't necessarily mean that others aren't figuring out ways to pull together services from various other resources. It's a matter of how far you can stretch that and sustain it over time that I think becomes a challenge without some of the base level funding coming from the state. But there are a lot of models out there for how and where dollars are pulled from, and other funders, foundations, counties, and others who are putting money into these efforts that are allowing that to happen. I would say you're absolutely right. In the instance where you have housing with no services and the person needs services, you don't have supportive housing, you just have housing. But that isn't the case that we're seeing in all the instances of what we're still working on here with the long-term homeless effort.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Not to belabor the point, but in my opinion, so I have a supportive housing development that's going on in my district. And so in talking to them, without getting service dollars from the state, they won't be able to leverage the dollars from the broader community in order to break ground and to develop that. So often what I see is supportive housing that looks at what DHS is going to provide for them as base funding for them to go out and leverage that with philanthropic organizations, counties, et cetera. So I guess I just want to make, it's not for you to answer, I just want to make that point that if we are not going to fund the services for supportive housing, then we're probably, even if we build it from the housing agency side, we're just building housing without support.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Proceed.
Madam Chair, there is one change page, which I believe is page 30, and may directly follow the pages we just discussed, if that's correct, and the way your packet is set up. You have a change page called Fraud Prevention Investigation. As I mentioned before, I think that the policy for this is actually under the Human Services area. The current funding for Fraud Prevention Investigation is in the base budget page that I just talked about, the other Children and Family Services grant. So I'll give you a brief explanation of what this proposal is doing. Fraud Prevention Investigation is part of the Fraud Investigation Public Assistance Programs that we set up, actually started piloting in 1990, and is currently operating in 55 counties. The counties operate under contract with DHS. We provide the money, which is around $1.5 million a year. The county's been able to leverage federal reimbursement to make this about a $2.8 million current effort in the 55 counties. This really focuses on recipient fraud in food stamps, MFIP, medical assistance, general assistance, and child care assistance programs. The program is a little bit different from traditional fraud control, which is more focused on investigation, prosecution, kind of a criminal approach. This is more trying to identify problems out ahead, capture them, and identify them, to use civil procedures such as claims and collection and disqualifications from programs, rather than using the more intensive and expensive court prosecution direction. It's been very effective. We prevent spending about $4 for every dollar we spend on the program. What's happened over time with this program is with the flat state funding of $1.5 million, the counties are pressured now to continue providing the same level of service, same level of investigations going forward as their costs increase year by year over the last 9 to 10 years. We began to look at options for how to address that concern. And it looks, on the one hand, if you can ask the counties to do less and we'll get less investigations going forward. You could ask the counties to keep doing what they're doing, which means they would have to start picking up more of the cost, which is not an attractive option from their side. The option that we landed on was to take the fraud investigation program over and run it from the state level. What this proposal does is take the current $1.5 million that's granted to the counties, appropriates into the department's administrative account. We're also able to access the same federal reimbursement of about $1.3 million. And so for about the same amount of money, you can see there's a small savings here. It's a little bit less than we're currently spending on the program. We believe we can operate the program more effectively and more efficiently from the state level. We propose that instead of operating in only 55 counties, we would hire investigators who couldn't cover the entire state, all 87 counties. Part of the reason we believe we can do that is there's a lot of variation within the current program across the state, across the counties, and the multi-county organizations who run the program. Some of them run much more efficiently and at a higher end, and some of them are not so efficient. In the current program, the average investigator does 17 investigations per month. But when you look at the programs that are working really well, they're doing 25 to 30 investigations per month. We believe that by operating it centrally, we can get ourselves more up into that 25-30 range. We're estimating an average of 28 investigations per month, meaning that we can actually do more investigations for the same amount of money. We also can direct and prioritize resources more efficiently because we can operate it from the state level and identify where we need resources to be going for the highest priorities. We also can ensure more consistency and develop common practices in an easier way across having a state workforce doing this. We propose to sort of phase this in during fiscal year 2010. We phase out the county grants, begin hiring the state staff, and have ourselves fully staffed with 25 investigators, 2 supervisors, and a support staff by February of 2010. This proposal would continue to serve the whole state. We would probably have some investigators who would be located permanently outside the metro area. We would certainly have investigators who would be assigned outside the metro area. And we want to have investigators who are working with a county or a set of counties so they can have the relationships built that are necessary in order to really work the program well and work well with the county staff in the program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, Commissioner Johnson, I'm just wondering, you know, I have yet to hear from counties or local government, whatever the entities are, whether it's, you know, an issue of housing or health or social services or any of those, but or beyond that into other areas. I've yet to hear where a state program could come in and do a better job with regard to the fact that we need to tailor things in local areas. You know, when somebody comes in from the outside, they don't really know why we have those variations within counties. And I guess it's my real concern that how much more effective will this be? Yes, it might save some money, but is it actually going to do the job? Is it actually going to treat the people fairly, you know, that are being investigated? I guess it's my contention that the local folks that have been working with these people for a long time usually have a pretty good idea of what's going on in their communities. And it sounds to me, maybe I'm wrong here, but it sounds to me like you're anticipating taking it out of their hands, and so it would be a removed state organization coming into test, regardless of whether they lived there for 5 months or 2 months or something like that. I would just like to know how you feel that that's going to actually provide not only the same level of service in checking for fraud, but also making sure that it's not just some far distant person looking at a situation where they don't really know all of the ramifications and what's, you know, the background.
Madam Chair and Representative Saylor, I think that is one of the key questions, because this program does depend on having good relationships with the people, particularly who work in the counties and with the communities. And so that would be one of the things that we would very much focus on, ensuring that those relationships are in place. We also would look to the current investigators as potentially people that we would hire to be the investigators for this program, so that would provide some of the continuity potentially for people coming into the new program. We believe that part of it is that that variation doesn't exist just because, necessarily because of local conditions, but in part because we have not enough activity going on in a certain area for the amount of money that's there, and so you may just have not, we need to look at how we target those resources and use them more strategically across a broader area in order to be more effective in doing it. I think that you're raising a fair issue, which is that it's challenging to make sure that you have the right relationships in place. But we recognize that, and that'll be one of the very important things we'll try to focus on.
Representative Saylor, and follow-up. And I would just, I guess I would like to say that, you know, I understand the situation with some counties not maybe having the numbers of cases to deal with, but, you know, if those people that were already employed by the county or other local government units, they always seem to have plenty of work to do that they can't do because they're doing other things. So I guess it would seem like, you know, possibly one could look at, you know, when you talked about the variations that, you know, maybe aren't as efficient, find the lack of, you know, the problems with efficiency, identify those, and then ask those local people to do those efficiencies. But at the same time, if there's, you know, half a day, perhaps, or 2 days a week that they're not doing the enforcement or fraud protection, I'm sure there are many other things that they could be doing as well, and then you'd still have that local person doing the job and yet not, you know, sitting around. I think that we could find things for them to do.
And Madam Chair, some of the investigators we have now are part-time. They do investigation part-time and other work for the county in the remainder of their time. Certainly that would be an adjustment that would happen over time if we were to not do as we're proposing here and were to have less money available over time. We'd probably see more and more shrinking to part-time investigators doing this work. We think that full-time investigators can be more effective because that's the work they're focused on, the work they know, and so that's part of why we're not interested in seeing ourselves go too far down the path of ending up with a lot of part-time investigators as opposed to people whose full-time job is to investigate and understand how to identify welfare fraud.
So, Commissioner, do you expect there'll be some local layoffs then? Is that what this is leading to?
Madam Chair, that would be up to the local entity, if it's the county usually, who's employing the folks, as to whether they found another job for them within the county or whether they laid them off. But the funding that they are currently using to support that person would be taken away under the way this is structured.
Okay. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thanks for being here. Just a follow-up kind of to Representative Taylor's question. Wouldn't this kind of fall under the consolidation of cities and counties that could work together and, you know, what do you say, maybe the caseload isn't as heavy in one county, can you not consolidate that, those services?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's potentially true, yes, how this would interact with the proposal to create regional authorities in human services. That might address some of this, but it wouldn't address necessarily that we're still only, with the money we have right now, in a position to serve 55 counties. I guess we'd have to look at what that map would look like if we had fewer entities and how we could stretch the dollars differently and if we could do essentially the same thing we're proposing here under that model. We think this is a more direct way to get it. We think it's just one of those services where there are some services that can be done better centrally and some that can be done better locally, and we think actually on balance we can do this better and more efficiently centrally. And I think as we're working with the counties on sorting out what they do and what we do, this is the way we're seeing this issue working best for what the service they're trying to provide.
And then another question, Beth. Thank you on that, Beth. What would you say is the ratio of fraud prevention specialists or fraud prevention workers that you have per recipient? What is, do you have any kind of ratio statistics?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we could get that for you. I can't do it off the top of my head.
Okay. And then there's one more question in chat. Where are we on the EBT fraud that was investigated earlier this summer? Where are we? Is that investigation ongoing, and what is becoming of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, there was not fraud identified this summer. What was identified was that we do have individuals who use their EBT cards outside of Minnesota. That is legal. It can be fraud, but it is not necessarily fraud. And we have, well before that information was released publicly in August, we have been sending for several years now, our fraud investigators every month get a list that shows them individuals using EBT outside of Minnesota for more than three consecutive months, as a way to help them identify where there may be cases where somebody may not be living in Minnesota but is using their EBT cards. There are a lot of good explanations for why people may be using a card outside of Minnesota, obviously border situations being one, but also when people move, if they still have benefits on their EBT card, they can use those in the new state, the remaining benefits they have left on their card, and that's most often why the benefits are showing up in other states, because someone has moved, had benefits left, used them. 85% of the transactions we see happen the first 1 to 2 months after the case shows up in the other state, suggesting that it's a moving situation. And of course, also people do go to weddings and funerals and other family emergencies that take them to other states.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Johnson, I guess I like the idea of getting this standardized throughout the states. I'm just wondering, in some of the counties that may be doing an effective job of it currently, are you open to some kind of a grant program or whatever to kind of blend these systems? Say maybe Dakota County or Crow Wing County has got a real effective situation. They may have their current employee maybe in his last few years and under that pension plan that's different or something. I'm wondering, is that a possibility where this could be blended so we could be reaching out to all the counties?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, that's not a discussion we've had with the counties to date, but I think it is an issue we could raise with them and have some discussion on. It would be another way to go about this.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Johnson, what I do want to say is I was really surprised last year when I was door knocking at the number of folks that work in the health and human services field that were disappointed that what they thought was an unjust system, where people that were deserving of benefits were not able to get them because they thought that the fraud that was present in the system was not being handled properly. That they thought that folks were able to skirt it, that the courts weren't properly handling it, that they, even when it seemed like they had evidence. So I think you're looking at an area where there is a perceived problem for sure within the people that are working within it. They look at it, and on the surface, many times I had people come up to me, and Madam Chair, they're often nervous to mention it. They say, you know, Denny, you're not going to keep track of my name or anything now, here, are you? You know, I just want to tell you, I think the system needs some adjustment. And we have to realize that if there's people taking the money unfairly or illegally, are not deserving. Potentially, there's deserving people that aren't getting the money. So I think the idea that you want to have fraud investigations looking at it, thank you. And but I would be conscious, there's probably some counties, and I don't know if mine is one or not, or one of my counties is good, but if they are good, I hope we're open to the discussion of blending this together.
Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, it's been my experience in my 10 years here that usually when the state takes over something that we do locally, it just doesn't work as well as we thought it would. And I know that I've talked to two different fraud investigative people in my three counties, and they both don't believe that your system is going to work as well. You may save some upfront costs, but you're not going to discover and collect as well as they are now. So you're going to lose the revenue that you find. The question I have specifically is, under the current system, the county investigator finds some fraud and we follow it through, and some of those dollars are recaptured. Does some of that stay with the county and then some of it goes to the state? I see you nodding your head, so I'm going to assume that some goes to the county. So now, see, here's what I'm thinking really is going to happen. This is just my being leery of government. Is you've created a larger workforce, you've circled the wagons, you're going to capture the money that the counties capture, you're going to make your books look a little bit better, but it's not ongoing funding that Chairwoman Clark or Chair Huntley have to give you on an annual or biennium basis. It's just money that you can use to do other things. I'm very suspicious. I don't think you're going to do as well. I would like to see this stay as is, and I guess it would be my intention to work with Representative Saylor and others, and hopefully we can keep it the way it is. And maybe if you want to do a trial run, Madam Chair, I hate to say this, but could we try it in the 7 county area first?
Madam Chair, in answer to the question, right, the way it works now is that half of the non-federal share is retained by the county when they get collection, the other half comes to the state. Mm-hmm. This proposal doesn't change that. The county would continue to get a share of the collection that was made. We are projected, this proposal doesn't include any optimistic or pessimistic or otherwise projections of any change in collections. We're assuming at this point there's not going to be any change in collections, even though we're proposing we can do more investigations, which could lead to more collections. We haven't tried to bake anything in here. This is strictly based on the admin spending that we have now that currently goes to the counties. We're going to pull it back to the state and just do it differently with the admin money. And it is our expectation that we will continue to do more investigations and hopefully get more collections out of that rather than fewer.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm encouraged by your enthusiasm, but I'm still very skeptical. I've always found that doing things on a local level is done better, and the money is spent more wisely. We're looking at $1 million. We're not looking at $300-400 million like, the Crystal Palaces in St. Paul, no offense. But I've said enough.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Johnson, did you mention how much money you collect annually? Or do we have? I'm just trying to get my hands around. I see how much it costs for us to investigate. Do we know how much money we actually collect as part of this process?
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I don't believe that I have that information with me. I can get that for you. It's not broken down between how much is collected through the fraud prevention investigation and traditional fraud control work. And the fraud control would continue to be done by the counties under this proposal. The counties currently fund all that and do that on their own. That's the work that is more about prosecuting the more egregious kind of fraud, taking cases to court and so forth. This work is more sort of on the civil, try to catch the pieces early. So I'm just warning, the dollar amount we have is across all of the fraud, not just the portion for FPI, because it's often difficult to identify what actually resulted and how we collected the dollars.
Representative Hayden.
Commissioner Johnson, can you give me more of a practical example of what the state does as part of the prevention? I guess I'm just really having a hard time tracking the difference between, long time ago, I was a financial worker. So the idea that someone signs up, they get the benefit, whatever it is, and that for some reason either they have someone living in the house that they're not reporting and there's extra income, or they move, or they say they have more kids than they have in their household. I mean, just give me a couple of practical examples of the difference between the two. I'm just trying to wrap my head around that a little bit.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, referrals for fraud, and particularly within the FBI, most often come from the financial workers. It's situations where financial workers identify that something doesn't seem quite right with the case, and that may be a variety of different things. It's usually a suspicion that there's excess income there, maybe suggested by the house that someone owns or something like that, that tips them to think that. Where the referral goes depends a little bit on the county, whether they would send it maybe to the county attorney's office to look at if it's going to be a traditional kind of a case, or the sheriff, or whether it would go to a fraud prevention investigator. Depends a lot on the internal practices of the county as to how they handle things like that. And if it's a bigger scale kind of thing, then they might move it from a fraud prevention over to the fraud control because they want to look at prosecution instead of that program disqualification as a kind of a tool that they've used. But what happens then is the investigator takes the case and does their investigation and try to identify whether there in fact is any irregularity there. They then would further identify whether it was an intentional program violation or something that may have been just information the client forgot to report, was not intentional. We would still do a collection back if there was an overpayment made on that, but there wouldn't be any disqualification from the program or any kind of a criminal action taken because it was not deemed to have been intentional. If it was intentional, then you have essentially two doors to go through. One is to disqualify the person from the program, which is a fairly streamlined and quick thing to do, or to take a criminal and then actually pursue a criminal remedy through the court.
Mr. Hayden.
Is there a threshold? Is there a dollar amount threshold, or is it simply subjective to the investigator as to what route they may go, disqualification, overpayment, or criminal charges being filed?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I don't think there is a strict dollar amount, but that does determine sometimes whether we'll look at it as being, but it is more up to the individual investigator. You know, in the criminal sense, what matters is intent, and so even if it's only a few dollars, if there's clear intent there, it may actually look like you could look at it as fraud. But different counties handle these differently, and some of the larger counties that have bigger volume put dollar thresholds as to when they'll go in and start looking at an investigation because it's not going to be worth their time relative to the other potential work that they could do on much larger cases out there. So there is some variation across the state on how that gets handled and identified.
So I guess what I would want to know beyond who controls it, I'm very interested in the program. So I think the dollar amounts collected, even a sense of how much dollars we saved would be helpful. I'm starting to figure out that sometimes we spend a lot of money to prevent something that so we spend more money trying to prevent it than actually is happening. And maybe that's not true. Maybe there's an incredible amount of welfare fraud or MSIP fraud or public assistance fraud going on, or maybe you actually prevent a lot. But there's my sense, without having those numbers, is that we're spending a lot of money chasing our tails a little bit on this issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, okay. We can provide you both with what we collect back, but also how we talk to cost avoidance, which is another way that we measure effect, and we can show you what that looks like.
Representative Hayden, I just want to say you're onto something, because for years we've had this discussion about what really the cost of fraud prevention or fraud prosecution, either one of those, has compared to what's saved or prevented, and it's usually quite extreme the other way, that it costs a lot more than what is saved. We've had those discussions for years, but I did notice when you were introducing this topic that you talked about preventing $4 for every $1, and I was wondering where that figure comes from, because I don't see it here, and I was trying to figure out, are you projecting certain kinds of fraud? I mean, where does that number come from? How can you find that?
Madam Chair, that's within the current FBI program. That's our estimation of the cost avoidance for every dollar that we spend in investigation of this $1.5 million that we're spending of state money. We're avoiding $4 in cost by preventing fraud that would have otherwise gone forward for longer and lost more money in terms of state expenditures. That's in answer to Representative Hayden's question. That's the calculation that we can show you how it is that we come up with that.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I'd be interested in. What's your assumptions are there? I think that would be helpful. Maybe it's changed in the last few years, but I don't know. But the question you raised is one that we've raised a number of different times. I think the next person is up to Blaine.
Yes, two things I'm looking at. What is the percentage that you, or do you have these numbers of the percentage that actually are unintentional and you clear it up, pay it back, whatever, or that moves into a program disqualification or that actually moves to criminal case? And then the other thing is you said some of the bigger counties may do less because they have more work, heavier alert workload. Would this be complicated then if we move it to the state level and have the whole state as the workload? But do you have the percentages of the different areas?
Madam Chair, I don't. I can see if we have that and provide it. I think that part of what moving to the state level will allow us to do is to target the resources where we're going to get the most bang for the buck, and that's actually an advantage as opposed to a disadvantage, that we may be looking at sometimes at trying to find where the larger cases are. But from my perspective, it also helps us that I think we can be more consistent in terms of looking at what are the trends that we're looking for, what are the kinds of issues that we're seeing in the case load, so we can manage that across a single group of investigators, so we can have more sort of real-time reaction to what's going on within the program.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up on Representative Lane's question, is there a ratio between people who are fraudulently using this program and to the people who are using it in the correct manner?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, all we can tell you is when we identify fraud. We can't tell you what fraud might exist that we don't see. And so we can get to you numbers that will show you, you know, how much fraud we identified over a particular time period and show that as a percentage of the overall caseload, which then gives you a sense of how much fraud is being detected within the caseload. But obviously we can't tell you the fraud that we may not have detected within the caseload because we don't know about it.
Well, I'm just, Mr. Rosenthal. Madam Chair, I'm just asking, to the cases you've found, what's that ratio?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I don't know, but we can get that information for you.
Do you have a, Mr. Johnson, do you have a ballpark figure? This must be, and this is a program that you're changing, so you must have thought about this somewhere.
I just don't have those two numbers in my head, so I could give you the quick.
Okay, all right. I think one question I'd add to this, and then we'll move on, which is maybe you could also get us some information on those mistakes that come from the agency. I've probably been contacted by a dozen people or so over the years that have been overpaid, not because they chose to, but there was some mistake from the agency, and they're required to take it out of their payments. And sometimes it's an extreme hardship. They didn't know that they were going to be overpaid, and I don't know how often that happens, but I'd be interested in any numbers you can give us on that too. And there's no consequences apparently for the agency when that happens. It's all considered to be comes out of the future payment of the family.
Madam Chair, we can get that information for you. I'm not sure that there's no consequence because that is, we do track that for quality control purposes, and that would be considered an error, and that requires correction by the agency in terms of why the error was made and ensuring that those kind of errors aren't happening in the future.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, let's move on.
Madam Chair, I think that I'm done.
Any other questions? Okay. I just want to go back one quick question. It looks like in terms of youth homeless, there's $0. Is that right? Did I look at that correctly for 2010 and 2011, runaway and homeless youth. We're back to that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. You're looking at page 337, that was one-time money that was appropriated.
I might just point out to committee members, but we found that situation a few years ago, and it turns out that the state's homeless program or policy for homeless youth basically is, in that case, when there are no continued state dollars, is basically to give them a bus ticket to ride the bus all night long, right? And that hasn't changed, I guess. We're going back to that.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of that policy.
You're not aware of that policy? Okay. You know, we are going to take a tour, and I would like to invite you to join us, Commissioner, because one of the things that our providers of homeless services have indicated to us in several instances that is the policy, that what they do, since there is no place for those young people to be overnight, is to give them a bus ticket and encourage them to ride the bus all night long.
Madam Chair, I'm distinguishing between what they may do and what may be a state policy. I don't believe there's any state policy that says that they should do that with runaway homeless people.
I see. Okay. Representative Hayden.
sorry, Commissioner Johnson. So what is the state policy to work with young people who are, I mean, if we're zeroing out the dollars on the Runaway Youth, Homeless Youth Act, what is our policy to deal with young folks that are homeless and need a place to go?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I don't know if there is a policy per se. There has been in place, as these dollars represent, a grant program to help assist programs that exist in the community to serve this population. There has not been, over the course of time, and in fact these dollars were brand new when they were put there, really much state money or state involvement at all in the issue of runaway and homeless youth. It's been something that's done more on a nonprofit and local government kind of level.
Madam Chair. So we don't have a policy, an official policy, to deal with young folks that are that have either run away or that are homeless. I mean, I just want to be clear about that.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I believe that there may be something in statute that addresses there's an act, but the question becomes more one of are there dollars to support the services that are actually needed for that population, and that's where, as you can see, we've had some one-time dollars, but beyond that, there's been no sustained effort from the state level for that population.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden, I might point out, we did pass a bill a couple years ago that required the state to do some planning for this, because it is such a crisis. It continues to be a crisis, and it sounds like it's going to be a bigger crisis again. So thank you very much for your testimony today. We're going to move on, committee members, to the presentation from the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Welcome, committee. Roberta Oppheim, please. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roberta Oppheim. I am the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities for the state of Minnesota. We were asked to make a very brief presentation on the budget, so I will briefly go through the items, and then if there are more specific questions that people want about what we do, I'll be glad to answer those questions. We were created to provide some independent oversight to the service delivery system for persons with mental health, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency and emotional disturbance, to be a resource to those citizens to make sure their rights were protected, that appropriate services were being provided, and help them navigate extremely difficult, complex bureaucratic systems. We also do death and serious injury reviews on the system to try and look for opportunities to improve conditions in the future to prevent like occurrences. We do civil commitment training and resource center. We produce client rights under the civil commitment system, documents, fact sheets. And then part of all of that work leads into what I consider a systemic quality monitoring and or systemic quality reports or public reports on what is either right or wrong with the system or a particular provider. There's been no expansion of the basic core functions of the agency, and we have continued to operate under the fundamental base budget for the past five biennium. There's been no expansion of the base to allow for meeting of the unmet needs. I'm not talking about new programming or new ideas, but simply the base of the citizens that we serve. We recognize we were not intended to be all things to all people. We're not a regulatory agency, but we do have unmet needs. Our agency is organized, we have 17.2 FTEs. We are a completely standalone state agency. We cover the entire state of Minnesota in six regional offices around the state. We have a 15-member governor's appointed advisory board. Five of those members also serve on a medical review subcommittee that reviews the deaths and that we see in the system. The scope of our oversight includes 480-plus agencies around the state and over 12,000 facilities that at any given time someone in a four-bed foster home might be there because of a mental illness, developmental disability, and would have a right to contact us. Obviously, that doesn't mean we have to be in all those facilities every year, all the time. Our agency-based budget, as of the current biennium, is $1.6 million per year, or $3.3 million for the biennium. That is all general fund money. However, the agency does collect federal financial participation, and therefore we return $300,000 or $600,000 a biennium back to the general fund to offset our operations and other operations in the state. 95% of the agency budget is in what we would call fixed costs. The majority of that, of course, being labor to provide these services to the citizen, and of course rent is a fixed cost, and we can't do our business without telephones, so there's a baseline that we have to have. The balance being 5% of the budget is your normal, you know, copiers, computers, supplies, those types of things. Part of our work is to help ensure system is cost effective. It's not just about rights, but it's about cost effective. And so as an example, if by doing training on civil commitment we can prevent inappropriate commitments, because people understand the law, an average commitment costs the system, whether it be the courts or others, an average of $10,000 a piece, all the way up to a cost of perhaps $50,000-$60,000 for a civil commitment of a sexually dangerous person or sexual psychopath. We absolutely understand that the magnitude of the problem is so large that we want to be part of the solutions to help the state balance the budget. So with that, the only change item to the base budget is the governor's recommended 5% of our agency-based operations, and that amounts to about $75,000 per year. And so with that, the strategies that we're employing is that we have an individual retiring, and it's a management position. We will be eliminating that management position. We have a student worker, and we're not sure whether we'll be able to hire another one when this one leaves for higher education opportunities. We will be reallocating some staff from our medical review function back into the direct service to citizens. We have been able to modestly reduce some of our rental space, and of course we'll keep a very tight watch on the travel expenses. The interesting thing is when you have six offices around the state, many of the meetings require us to go to the meetings. We'll try to conduct more of our business by phone and email and some of the other electronic devices, but sometimes there's just not a replacement for the face-to-face support that is required in some of the meetings and some of the situations for the individuals. We certainly understand that the impact's going to be that, despite making every effort to try and minimize the negative effect on the citizens that we serve, we currently aren't able to meet every request for assistance. So the agency simply won't be able to accept some cases that we would like to, and we will have to further refine which deaths and serious injury gets reviewed. System investigations and system improvement will receive a higher priority, and so some of that work will have to be reduced. With that, I would stand for questions.
Questions for committee members. Representative Mechner, are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Holpheim, I do have a couple of questions.
Certainly.
You have, I think this is a great one, if we could just take a minute and understand it. So you have 17 employees. How many of them are what I would refer to on the ground doing the work, and how many of them are what more would be behind the scenes management type folks?
Chair and Representative McNamara, well, it's interesting because in some sense we don't have anyone doing totally background work. We have myself as the ombudsman and with this configuration, there's a director of policy and administration, but both of us, I handle some cases directly myself. The director of policy and administration handles all of our requests from citizens for data, and so is working directly with citizens if they're making a, you know, data request or information request. Even our receptionists, we have a receptionist, and then we have what I would call your typical payroll, purchasing clerk, bill payments. But both of those individuals work in what I would call some of the direct services, in that they take in all the reports, get them into the system, the death reports, the serious injury reports, get them out to the appropriate staff who have to take a look at them or be aware of them. And then we have one computer technology person who's almost consumed with as rapidly as computer technology goes out. Everyone else is in direct services.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up to that. And where did the position that's going to be, I think you referred to it as a supervisor that was retiring, I believe,
yes,
or leaving, and where did that person fit in on that explanation you just gave on where some of their duties picked up by other folks, and which folks are going to pick those up, and how is it affected by the what I would again refer to the front line?
The individual that is retiring has served as sort of the director of client services and direct supervision of staff, and doing a lot of that systemic work, going to task force meetings, taking what the advocates and the regional ombudsman tell them, and then although all of our parties from time to time sit on work groups and task forces to improve the system, he's sort of the key leader. So some of that will be diminished because he won't be available. The supervisory functions at this point, it's somewhat unclear, but as long as it's unclear, it rests on my desk. So for the line staff, that may mean that maybe the performance reviews aren't done as frequently and as timely, or some of the other bureaucracy may take a little longer, just because if I'm doing cases, if I'm doing some of the systemic work and the supervision. But right now, I will be taking over all those day-to-day calls. What do I do in this case? How do I, you know, they all have my cell phone number, and absent of committees like this, I respond. So.
One more quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And how much frontline work did this gentleman do?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, at this point it would be difficult for me to quantify, but I would say at least 50 to 60% of his work would be frontline work.
Steph, I have a question.
Yes.
When you began your presentation, you indicated that there's already unmet need.
Mm-hmm.
Can you quantify that a bit? I mean, the work you do is dealing with deaths and serious injury and complaints of people who are quite vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about in terms of unmet need at the current rate, which I guess if you're doing a 5% cut is going to increase, but what are we talking about in terms of?
As always, the uncounted number is the difficult one to quantify, Madam Chair, members of the committee. At this point, what I would do is relate to you the kinds of situations that come to our attention. There are situations that come to our attention that are very difficult, and whether it be a small, minor item in the scope of the system, I always remind myself it's obviously the most important thing to that individual at the time they contact us, or they wouldn't have taken the time to contact us. So we always treat it with respect, but in terms of, there are situations of indignities that go on, day-to-day things where we might be able to have a conversation with a provider or part of the system that simply can't happen because we have too many other cases. And one of the balancing acts that our staff always has to do, and is difficult for people whose hearts are as wide as the ones that work for me, is
that puts an extreme stress on them when they have to say, no, I can't help you with that, because something is important, it was something bad that happened, but maybe it's a little too old to fix or turn around in the current scenario, but would be very legitimate to investigate for systemic improvement. We don't have the resources to take on some of the extremely complex cases that cross many systems, because there's a lot of he said, she said, and there's a real delicate opportunity in how you ferret out from he said, she said, what really went on. And those take extreme resources, but it's difficult to count. In some respects, it would be nice could they simply log in, you know, we have a provision that says, would be our client but unable to assist, and you think we could generate those numbers, and if the committee would like, I would try to quantify that. But I will tell you, one of the things that has suffered the most in the work is the getting of all the data entry into the system. So if they get a simple phone call and they say, well, it's not, you know, we're not going to be able to help you, one thing we try to do is get them to another resource, so then they may not check unable to assist. Or two, if it's a 5-minute phone call, 10-minute phone call, it may never get its way into our system, because our system's a case tracking system, not a data management system. So if it doesn't rise to a case, it may or may not get into the system. And of course, as the lead manager, director of the agency, I'm always harping on getting the paperwork in, but the human side of me understands that there's a volume of phone calls that you need to take, and at the end of the day, there's, you know, X amount of time to get all that clean paperwork into the system.
Well, I have a question. It looks like you've had about at least 10% increase in 07 and 08 in the serious death and serious injury reports that you're recording here. And I presume is that a trend that's been going, increasingly going up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when I first started, which was 15 years ago, to give you a scope of time, we were getting maybe 200 to 300 deaths a year. We're up to about 500 to 600 deaths a year. Some of that's improved reporting, but it's still nonetheless workload indicators. And our serious injuries were 500 to 800 a year, and now they're running about 1,200 to 1,300 a year. And I assure you that the woman that's in charge or coordinates the death and serious review process is probably one of the most organized and efficient workers I have, because assuming it's not a holiday, a day off, or a vacation, every single one of those reports is read by her and thoughtfully triaged within 24 to 48 hours of them coming in. You can start to see the volume. And that's not the only thing that she does. So, but it does put a strain on the system.
So just to review this, what we're talking about here is a reduction in service of people who have called your agency because in some cases there's a serious injury or a death in a Minnesota facility that's serving a vulnerable person. Are these all adults?
It's adults and children.
What percentage would you say are children? What percentage?
Boy, I have to check. Because the DD population, developmental disabilities population, isn't broken out by children and adults the way the mental health population is broken out by adults, I don't have that figure readily available, but I could go in and have our tech person try to sort through the AIDS. We try to collect the AIDS on all of our cases. So yeah. That was something I would have to get back to you on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Those numbers are disturbing to see that we have an increase, and that the recommendation is to cut that. But I was actually looking at the numbers, and it looks like it's not a 5% reduction. If I'm looking at the budget page right, it says minus 2.4%. Is that, and that is for the biennium. Is it really a full 5% reduction, or is that because you're counting for people who are not being who are being eliminated, the position being eliminated?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had the same reaction when I saw that 2.4%. from my understanding, that's against a previous biennium actual spending rate. And we had some carry forward money from year to year that we were allowed to carry forward. So it was against actual dollars versus what. But the $75,000 is right around 5% of the actual base, which is on the change page.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for your... And we'll look for that information that you will provide us.
Thank you.
Okay, the next person that we're going to hear from is from the Board of Medical... Let's see. Board of the Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators and Administrative Services Units. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In the spirit of time management, we'll try to cut our comments down so that you can adjourn by 12 o'clock. I'm Randy Snyder. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators, and we are also the lead agency assigned the Administrative Services Unit, or ASU. With me is Julie Vagnas, who is that lead staff member and the accounting supervisor by title. My role today is just introduce the 15 health licensing boards that the state of Minnesota currently has in place. They will be coming forward one at a time. I think you only have 12, as three are out for various needs. So good news is we've saved some time already there. We will process through this very quickly, though. Minnesota has 15 health licensing boards. That's fewer than most states. The two largest boards are the Board of Medical Practice with 22,000 licensees and the over 104,000 nurses that are regulated in their individual practice by the Board of Nursing. The smallest board is the Board of Podiatric Medicine Examiners at 198 individuals and a 0.5 staff member. Collectively in Minnesota, there are approximately 250,000 licensees in health occupational licensee, and we receive about 3,291 complaints in the past year to handle consumer complaints. The health licensing boards were intentionally created as 15 independent state agencies to have citizens focused on the individual profession. The boards are directed by both public and professional licensees that serve on the board. They're all appointed by the governor and staggered four-year terms. Board member sizes range from 7 citizens to 20 citizens, setting and directing our rules after U.S. established statute. Funding for the boards is placed entirely in the Special Revenue Fund. They're 100% of our revenue is financed through fees, so we come in and establish our fees. We get spending authority for those fees and then must manage accordingly to those that have been approved through you. There are no general fund dollars allocated to the health licensing board. So no general fund dollars allocated to health licensing. And ASU does also, though, provide assistance to two general funded boards, the Board of Barbers and Cosmetology and the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. We're all co-located together. Back in 1993, the health licensing boards begin this ASU unit, and so we have a common business or back office function for all of the common accounting practices, the finance, human resources, contracting, purchasing, and IT were better provided as a shared service so that we could dedicate the expertise to the front line, to the actual citizens that are calling in with concerns or requesting to become licensed. And that is what we refer to as our ASU unit. And that same cooperative spirit today with looking at a legal analyst that we would add to our staff, as the Attorney General has decreased their paralegal staff, and we would we are seeking, and it has been approved through the governor's budget, to have a legal analyst that we would share amongst all the boards. And one final accomplishment in the world of wanting to have some good news, we do electronic government services or online licensing extremely well right now. Our model is known nationally. All of our boards offer online services, and most include online renewals. We typically have between 80 and 90% of our licensees that now renew online, and so we have made great strides in that. And overall, our fees for the majority of Minnesota licensees are at the 50th percentile or less. So we believe that we're providing a good service for the citizens at a lower than average cost. And unless the Board of Nursing tomorrow, I believe their average rate is $10 less than if you're a nurse in, or the average nurse in another state. So with that very brief introduction, try to summarize, we'll go right into ASU and the change items that we have in the governor's budget.
Thank you. Welcome to the chair.
Members of the committee, I'm here to discuss the two different change items, and on page 7 in the under the Board of Nursing Home Administrators, our first change item is for retirement costs. We are asking for a one-time appropriation of $201,000 in fiscal year 10 to cover 9 anticipated retirements of long-term state employees within 7 of the different health licensing boards. These funds will cover their severance and the vacation payout. In most cases, these funds go directly to the health care savings account for these retiring staff members. The administrative services unit would then transfer the appropriate amount of funds needed to each of the appropriate boards where the retirements will take place. Do you have any questions regarding that?
Any questions, members?
Our second change request is on page 8, and this is to fund a legal analyst position. We're asking for a permanent base increase of $85,000 in fiscal year 10 and $87,000 in fiscal year 11. This position will provide legal services of drafting of documents to all of the health licensing boards based on the needs of each of the boards individually. In the past, we received this service from the Attorney General's office, and they no longer will have paralegals available for us to get the service from. So we found the best approach is to hire our own legal analyst internally and then just use that staff person to serve any of the other staff within the administrative services unit. Are there any questions for that one? And then our third request, which is on page 10, is to increase our base budget for the Volunteer Healthcare Provider Program. This program purchases malpractice insurance to doctors, nurses, and dentists who provide volunteer services within the communities. Currently, we have 15 nonprofit organizations or clinics registered in the program and about 28 active volunteers. This program started in 2003 and has continued to grow each year. Our current base budget is $65,000, and we are asking for an increase of $14,000 in fiscal year 10 and $24,000 in fiscal year 11. The Administrative Services Unit receives no additional funds to operate this program, and 100% of this appropriation is used directly to purchase the malpractice insurance for the volunteers. This program will be funded through the receipts collected by the Board of Medical Practice, Nursing, and Dentistry, and are allocated based on the number of professions that each of those boards have in the program, and currently these boards collect sufficient revenues to cover the cost of the program. Any questions on this?
Any questions, members? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just have a question. I'm wondering, have there been any claims in this area so far or already that needed to be covered?
Members of the committee, there has been no claims reported at all or no complaints to the program or anything. It seems to be moving along smoothly. In all of the organizations and the clinics that are registered, I have not received any complaints from them either.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Is that all you have then?
That's all.
Madam Chair, I did remind you, the Board of Physical Therapy, the Board of Optometry, the Board of Dietetics and Nutritional Practice, and the Board of Podiatric Medicine are unable to attend today or tomorrow. If there are budget issues, Julie could perhaps respond to those if members had any concerns with those three boards.
Okay, and then did we intend to see some of the boards today?
Correct.
Okay, all right, thank you. Is it the Board of Medical Practice, Mr. Leach? Thank you. Welcome to the committee and state your name.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. I was told prepared today to come to you and kind of give you an overview of what the board does and how we do it. So I'll be try to be very brief. Randy covered a lot of it in his presentation on all the health licensing boards. We basically all operate the same way. The Board of Medical Practice regulates the practice of physicians in 6 other healthcare professions. Physician assistants, respiratory care practitioners, athletic trainers, acupuncturists, traditional midwives, and as of this year, naturopaths. Our mission as all the other health boards' mission is to protect the public, and basically we go about this in two ways. First, we ensure that any applicant for a credential in Minnesota meets all the minimum entrance to practice standards that are set forth in the statute. And secondly, we ensure that anybody who holds a credential to practice continues to practice with reasonable skill and safety to their patients. Our board issues approximately 1,000 new credentials every year, and we currently regulate approximately 22,000 healthcare professionals. We are receiving between 750 and 900 complaints each year, which is down from the all-time high back in the mid-90s of about 1,200 complaints. And our board issues anywhere between 60 and 75 disciplinary or corrective actions each year. Randy pointed out, all the, like most of the health boards, we receive no general fund dollars and operate entirely on the fees we collect from our credentialed professionals. The last time our board raised fees was in 1997. At that time, we did increase physician license renewal fees in order to meet increased contested case hearing costs and to rebuild our antiquated information technology system. Our IT project was completed in 2004, and the following year our system received state recognition by being awarded the Minnesota Government Recognition Award in the category of Customer Service Application at the 24th Minnesota Government IT Symposium. Currently, approximately a little over 85% of our licensees renew their credential online. In addition to that, we built into our system a physician profiling system, which back in the late 90s, a number of legislatures were forcing on state medical boards to build, and we determined that we were going to do it before the legislature told us we had to do it. Currently, we are receiving about anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 hits on our physician profiling system each week. So we consider that to be somewhat of a great success. I just want to point out that in addition to our service, our board members' service to the state of Minnesota, our board members are very active on a national level, participating in the Federation of State Medical Boards, which is our national organization. More board members in the state of Minnesota have served as chair of the board of directors for the Federation than any other state but two, and we're tied with them. This year, we will have one board member running for the board of directors and another board member running for a committee chair with the Federation of State Medical Boards. At this time, the medical board has no initiatives to raise any of our fees, and we have not included any change items in the governor's budget proposal for this biennium. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, members? Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. All right. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Pauline Walker Singleton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology. And my presentation will be very brief. The Board of Psychology is a state agency, as you know, that licenses and regulates people who practice psychology in the state. We are in charge of protecting the citizens from the unqualified, unethical, and unprofessional practice of psychology. As you're also aware, this agency receives no general funding and raises all of its revenues from fees such as the ones paid by applicants who are seeking licensure and licensees who are renewing their license to practice. The agency licenses approximately 3,700 licensees, and about 336 of those were added in the last biennium. The number of new complaints we received increased slightly over the previous biennium, and we are in a trend right now of closing more complaints. The agency has not raised its fees since 2001, and we operate within our appropriations. In 2001, we had to raise fees in order to accommodate for the increase in complaints and the cost of investigating those complaints. However, we've carefully managed the agency's budget, and we devote a significant amount of time to planning, streamlining our requirements and our procedures in the areas of licensure and complaint resolution, and in containing costs and expenditures. In doing so, the agency has not experienced a deficit for almost a decade, and none is anticipated in the near future. You've already heard that our agency contributes, along with the other health licensing boards, to the Administrative Services Unit, which allows 17 state agencies to voluntarily share the cost of such services as budgeting, procurement, personnel, and payroll. In addition, the Board of Psychology also collaborates with several of the other health licensing boards by hiring the services of the same software company to design licensure and enforcement software. Because we have common interests and goals for a software system, the agencies are able to contain the cost by cost of designing by sharing experts, purchasing hardware as a group, sharing information and strategies in regular IT meetings, and the group of health licensing boards benefit cost-wise because the company can reuse our similar design needs and simply adjust the system to account for our individual differences. The governor has included in his budget one of the agency's change items, and that is the retirement payout for an employee who is retiring early in the next fiscal year, 2010. And that's about all I have to say.
Any questions from Walker? No? Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Committee members, we didn't quite get through our list today. We have the Board of Social Work and the Board of Pharmacy, and we'll bring those up first thing tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, we're going to be adjourned now, so.